From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I know a lot of things about the crimes that have been committed in my country and other countries by the so-called authorities in this country. And for that, I think I'm a marked man.
The former drug czar of Haiti has been jailed here for more than a year. He says the U.S. has long known that newly indicted coup leader Michel Francois has been running drugs into this country.
When the U.S. went in with 20,000 troops, how come they didn't arrest Michel Francois then? His role in drug trafficking had already been not only pointed out by us, but also had come up when an informant testified in front of a Senate commission. So how come they didn't arrest him then?
How come they didn't, Patrick Haley?
The man was very useful to the CIA for a number of years.
The confirmation hearings for Anthony Lake as Director of Central Intelligence begin today. He's one of the architects of U.S. policy toward Haiti. We'll talk with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's just returned from the Caribbean country. And a woman comes forward in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, saying police asked her to testify falsely against him.
They began to insist that she saw the shooting and that she saw Mumia do the shooting. In fact, she did not, and she refused to assist them. But she knew Cynthia White, the prostitute who did testify against Mumia. They were longtime friends, and she knew that Cynthia White had testified as a result of the pressure that were put on the police.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. First, a look at the headlines. This is the lead story in the Washington Post today. It says, in a rare public confrontation, the White House and the FBI yesterday offered sharply conflicting versions of their contacts with each other concerning evidence of an alleged Chinese plan to influence U.S. congressional elections last year. President Clinton complained in an afternoon news conference that he had only recently found out about the alleged involvement of a foreign power in the elections because FBI agents who briefed National Security Council staff at the White House last summer, for whatever reason, asked that they not share the briefing, and they honored the request. Clinton said the president should know. Within hours, the FBI issued a public statement flatly rebutting this account, insisting it had, quote, placed no restriction whatsoever on the dissemination up the chain of command at the NSC on any information provided to the NSC senior staff. If that's true, that will further complicate President Clinton's effort to win Senate confirmation for Anthony Lake as Director of Central Intelligence. As they prepare to open hearings into the nomination today, Senate Republicans plan to grill Lake, who as National Security Advisor directed the NSC in Clinton's first term, about his knowledge of the China investigation. Twice delayed, today's hearing comes long after other members of Clinton's defense and foreign policy team were confirmed unanimously by the Senate. No such smooth sailing awaits Lake, whose personal finances and public activities as Clinton's national security advisor have come under scrutiny. In other campaign fundraising news, Al Gore made fundraising calls from his Senate office during his 1988 presidential bid. This according to his former aides who told the Knoxville News Sentinel. One of the aides said Gore made at least 24 calls in the spring of 1987. The staffers, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said they thought the fundraising was part of running for president. Federal law bans members of Congress from using their offices to make campaign fundraising calls. An ethics manual given to all senators includes that warning. And Senate Republicans today are virtually assured of winning approval for a probe that will focus solely on illegal fundraising for the 1996 presidential and congressional campaigns. The probe would exclude most of the $263 million in party-building soft money contributions collected by both parties. Democrats say Republicans simply want to bash their fundraising efforts, but GOP leaders are promising a fair investigation. And White House memos are shedding light on taxpayer-financed database. The documents suggest the aide who oversaw the project identified it as a key to President Clinton's plan to reward donors with White House access. The revelations are contained in passages of documents that had been censored and kept from congressional investigators for more than 6 months. They were finally turned over uncensored late yesterday. For weeks, the White House has maintained the database was used only for official purposes and not to aid the campaign, which would be potentially illegal. A Maryland NAACP leader says the majority of the sexual misconduct charges against instructors at the Army's Aberdeen Proving Ground aren't true. An Aberdeen spokesman denies the women were coerced into making false charges. He also denies the civil rights group's allegation that the Army unfairly targeted black soldiers based on white female complaints. This international news, Mexican authorities yesterday jailed two Jesuit priests on charges of leading a peasant attack in which two policemen were killed in the southern state of Chiapas. The Washington-based Human Rights Watch says the arrests are unjustified and the men were held incommunicado for 20 hours. The Catholic Church says the charges were fabricated and part of a campaign to discredit it. Relations between the church and the government have been sour since a Zapatista peasant uprising in 1994. And finally, a pregnant Irish woman wanted in Germany for questioning about a 1996 bomb attack at a British Army base will learn on Friday whether she's been granted bail. Lawyers for Roisin Michalski, who argued at a private high court hearing that she should be released from London's Holloway prison on health grounds, said the judge had adjourned the case until Friday. Michalski is due to give birth in May. She denies the charges against her. Roisin Michalski is the daughter of Bernadette Davlin Michalski. And you're listening to Democracy Now! It seems that each week the campaign finance scandals in Washington are spreading. The latest allegations are that China took advantage of campaign finance by making campaign contributions to buy influence with certain members of Congress. Well, we are giving you an opportunity to send a powerful message to the White House. Democracy Now! Once again is encouraging you to send an old coffee mug to the White House with a letter to President Clinton asking him to invite you over for coffee talk. Or if you want, you can call our 800 number and order a Democracy Now! Mug sent in your name by charging it on your credit card. You can go grab a pencil and I'll give you the number in just a second. We're calling this our Coffee, Tea, and Me campaign. If you call our 800 number, we'll send the White House a white mug which says Democracy Now! In red and blue lettering on one side. The other side says, Dear President Clinton, Coffee, Tea, and Me. And here's a letter that'll be sent in your name along with it. It says, Dear President Clinton, I've heard that you've invited big donors, corporate executives, bankers, and arms merchants to have coffee and conversation with you at the White House. I may not have much money, but I do have serious concerns about public policy and our country's future. I still believe in government of, by, and for the people, and I care deeply about the state of democracy in America. I welcome the equal opportunity to share my thoughts with you in person. Coffee, Tea, and Me. Democracy Now! Sincerely. And it's got your name and says, please send my invitation to, and it's got your name and address. So if you'd like to participate in Democracy Now!'s Coffee, Tea, and Me campaign to send a message to President Clinton, you can call our 1-800 number. That's 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I know there's been a lot of questions raised about checks being received at the White House, but I don't think there'll be as many questions raised about them receiving your mug. So you can call that number anytime today, and you can have a Democracy Now! Mug and personalized letter sent to the President, making a statement about how big money, corporate money, is destroying our democracy. We started this campaign yesterday on Democracy Now!, and we have been getting dozens of calls of people who want to get the mug themselves and also who want to send a mug with a message to the White House. Well, on with the show. Yesterday in Philadelphia, attorneys and supporters of journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal held a news conference. It's quite significant, the news conference. Death row inmate and former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal has long contended that police coerce witnesses to falsely testify against him. And that contention is being supported by the former lover of a corrupt city policeman. Pamela Jenkins, a 31-year-old former prostitute, said yesterday that police threatened the life of a witness who later helped convict Abu-Jamal of killing an officer. Jenkins' sworn statement appears in papers that Abu-Jamal's defense attorneys have filed seeking a new trial or dismissal of the case. We're joined now by Abu-Jamal's lead attorney, Leonard Weinglass. Len Weinglass, tell us what happened yesterday.
We filed with the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania an application for remand, asking the Supreme Court to send Mumia's case back to the trial level so that the testimony of Pamela Jenkins could be taken, cross-examined, and added to the record.
Who is Pamela Jenkins?
Pamela Jenkins is the prostitute who testified on behalf of the United States government In the case against the five officers who were convicted in the 39th District for their use of perjurious testimony, she had previously served as an informant for the city police and for the state police in Pennsylvania.
So she was a prostitute. The 39th District scandal is the one where cops in Philadelphia were fabricating charges against thousands of people?
Yes, and in particular, they paid her $500 to testify against a man named Carter in a murder case. Mr. Carter was convicted, did 10 years, and had to be released this year after all these revelations came to light.
I'm trying to remember the story. Is she the woman who was sleeping with two of the cops that had gone after Carter?
That's right. She had a long romantic relationship with Officer Tom Ryan, which started when she was 15 years old and in high school, and he was a truant officer.
And he was the one who asked her to testify falsely?
Yes. He brought Pamela Jenkins to an officer, a detective named Richard Ryan, and they began to insist that she saw the shooting and that she saw Mumia do the shooting. In fact, she did not, and she refused to assist them. She was saved from further pressure because of her relationship with Tom Ryan. But she knew Cynthia White, the prostitute who did testify against Mumia. They were longtime friends, and she knew that Cynthia White had testified as a result of the pressure that were put on the police. Cynthia had told Pamela that the police threatened to kill her if she didn't name Mumia as the shooter.
Where is Cynthia White today?
We're still looking for Cynthia. We suspect that she's in the custody of the police somewhere. She's being kept from us. Cynthia has an outstanding arrest warrant since 1987 on a serious charge of robbery, but she's never been brought in on that warrant, and she's never been questioned by the police since. As a matter of fact, she was released on that warrant at the insistence of the Homicide Division, which said that 5 years earlier she had testified against Mumia, and therefore she should be released. She was released by the court, and she never again showed up.
Why is Pamela Jenkins only stepping forward now in 1997? What is this, 15 years after Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted?
Well, Pamela Jenkins really was an unknown person until 1995, when she began to reveal what was happening in the 39th District. When we heard about her testimony on the 39th District, we located her at the end of 96. She was doing time in a prison in New Jersey. We went to see her, and we thought she might be able to tell us something about the police. We were shocked to find out that she, in fact, knew something about the case itself, and that she also had been asked to be a witness, and that she knew that Cynthia White had testified falsely as a result of the pressure that was put on her. She finally gave us a written sworn statement on January 9, 1997, so we moved as quickly as we could. But we first had to assess her involvement, then we had to locate her, which was not easy, and then we had to talk to her, and she ended up signing a sworn statement.
Where is the detective and the cop she was involved with today?
Tom Ryan was convicted of corruption, the man that she was romantically involved in, and he did 7 months in prison, and he's just recently been released.
And the detective that tried to pressure her?
The detective is still a detective, and we have new information that he's still involved in the process of hiding Cynthia White from our investigators.
What do you mean? What do you know?
Well, I can't go into it in great detail, but what's happening here in Philadelphia is a bit of a cat-and-mouse game. They now know that we're looking for Cynthia. They know that if she's brought in officially, she will have to answer to the 1987 robbery charges, so we believe that she's being unofficially hidden. You have to remember that Pamela Jenkins, when the FBI wanted her as a witness, and they finally got her and she testified before a federal grand jury, she was being hidden by the Philadelphia Police Department unofficially from, as she describes it, from one hotel to another until finally the FBI could catch up with her.
And this was in the police scandal of the 39th District
that's going on
to today as all these cases are being overturned and people are being released from jail.
That's right. So there is a history here of the police department unofficially taking witnesses and hiding them from people who are seeking them.
What did she think was happening at the time? What did Pamela Jenkins think was happening as they moved her from hotel to hotel? Why did they have a right to be moving her? Why was she in their custody?
Well, she knew that they were attempting to hide her from the FBI, and she was still romantically involved with Tom Ryan, and so she went along with it.
Well, right now, legally, where does this all leave the case? I mean, you had Veronica Jones come forward, testify in the original judge in Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, Judge Sabo's court, and he did not accept her testimony that she was pressured to say that she did not see people run away. So is that not being considered? The Veronica Jones testimony is now not being considered by the state Supreme Court?
Well, you're right, Amy. Not only did Judge Sabo not accept it, he struck her testimony from the record. Now we've asked the Supreme Court to reinstate her testimony and consider it. He did the same with William Singletary, another witness who came forward and who was interviewed by the police that night because he was found right at the scene, and he said Mumia was not the shooter. They also tore up his statements, and we presented that to Judge Sabo, and he testified, and Judge Sabo disbelieved him as well.
Len, explain who William Singletary was.
Yes, William Singletary was a man who was taken into custody that night because he was found right at the shooting scene minutes later. And the police acknowledged he was there. They acknowledged they took him into custody, and they acknowledged they interrogated him. However, they said he had nothing to add. When we found William Singletary, he said he had everything to add. He witnessed the shooting. He saw Officer Faulkner get shot. He knew that Mumia Abu-Jamal was not the shooter. He saw the shooter run away, the same as three other witnesses had done. And the police refused to accept his statement. They tore up statement after statement. Finally, they forced him to sign a false statement, and then they drove him out of business and eventually out of the city of Philadelphia.
What was his business?
He had a gas station. They kept breaking the windows of his gas station until finally the insurance company refused to insure him. And then he said things got progressively worse. He had a tow truck operation, which depended on the police to call him to scenes of accidents, etc. And when everything dried up, he just left Philadelphia. So all along, we've been asking the Supreme Court not to return these witnesses to Judge Sabo because the result is foregone. We're again asking them to have Pamela Jenkins testify before another judge sitting in the Court of Common Pleas. There are many good judges here in Philadelphia. And certainly they should be able to find one who doesn't have the bias of Judge Sabo.
What do you expect the state Supreme Court will respond to this latest information?
It's very hard to predict. I think first they will ask the district attorney to respond to the papers we filed yesterday. Then after they examine both sets of papers, they will decide whether or not they want briefs on this issue. That's what they did with Veronica Jones, the last remand. And then they will decide whether or not there ought to be a remand. They did remand the case for Veronica Jones. We're hoping they'll remand the case now for Pamela Jenkins.
What can you do that would take it out of Judge Sabo's court, since he has not exactly been sympathetic to anything you have done?
Well, the only thing we can do is to present before the Supreme Court all of the documented evidence that we have, which indicates the clear bias of Judge Sabo, and it's their call. We would hope that they would, upon examining this information, decide that Judge Sabo is not a suitable judge for this case. You know, the local newspapers, the Philadelphia Daily News, which is a very strong pro-police newspaper, has asked that Judge Sabo be removed. The Philadelphia Inquirer has commented on it. The New York Times has acknowledged his clear bias. Anyone who has spent a day in that courtroom knows that Mumia will not get a fair hearing there. And we've presented all this to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania, and now the next move is theirs.
Leonard Weinglass, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Len Weinglass, the lead attorney for death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal. And on a related note, the last 2 weeks we ran on Democracy Now! A set of commentaries of Abu-Jamal. Those commentaries, some of them, are now available on Pacifica Radio's worldwide webpage. Also on the website, a host of related materials. The address is www.pacifica.org. It's a great website, so check it out. Also, beginning today, Democracy Now! Is online, so you can go to the website and listen to Democracy Now! At your leisure. Again, the address, www.pacifica.org. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. Thank you. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Later this afternoon, the Senate confirmation hearings for President Clinton's nominee for Director of Central Intelligence begin. Anthony Lake is likely to face tough opposition from some Republican lawmakers. Among the areas that Anthony Lake was known for handling during his tenure as National Security Advisor was Haiti. Indeed, Haiti is often considered one of President Clinton's major foreign policy successes. So we thought we'd take a closer look today at the Clinton administration's policy in Haiti over the last several years, including a special look at Lake's record and that of the CIA. We'll be joined later in the show by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who's just returned from the Caribbean nation. But first, one of the CIA's reported Haiti agents, a former Army officer and key leader in the military regime that ran Haiti during the coup between 91 and 94, was indicted in Miami on Friday and charged with smuggling 33 tons of cocaine into the United States. Michel Francois was also known as a brutal leader of the repression in Haiti that claimed an estimated 5,000 lives during the coup regime. Here to discuss matters related to Haiti, the CIA, Anthony Lake, and Michel Francois is Patrick Ely, formerly the National Coordinator for Anti-Narcotics Policy, or Drug Czar, under President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. When President Aristide was ousted in the 1991 coup, led in part by Colonel Michel Francois, Patrick Ely fled to the United States. He returned with President Aristide in October of 94, back to Haiti, after 20,000 U.S.-led troops intervened in Haiti. Patrick Ely was then appointed to be Haiti's Secretary of State for Defense, where he oversaw the dismantling of the hated Haitian army. Patrick Ely, can you tell us, we're joined now by Patrick Ely, about Michel Francois, who was just indicted last week in Miami. I should point out that Patrick Ely is speaking to us from a jail in Virginia. So that question to you, again, Michel Francois, indicted just last week in Miami for smuggling 33 tons of cocaine into the United States. What do you know about him?
In 1990 and 1991, what I knew about Michel Francois was the fact that he had been, trained in Fort Benning's, like a number of Haitian military. He had been part of the Palace Guard, the presidential guard, and he was a very repressive type of officer. That was before President Aristide came in power. Then, of course, you know, as quite a large number of Haitian officers, he was involved in all kinds of shady deals. After the coup, he was probably the most repressive of the putschists, and he also was very much involved in the drug trade. As a matter of fact, I was able to intercept one of his radio communication when he was organizing the landing of a plane right in the middle of Port-au-Prince, and I had passed this information to U.S. authorities, including the station chief of the CIA down in Port-au-Prince, but nothing was done about it. That was in early 1992.
Who was the station chief?
At the time it was Don Terry. Mm-hmm.
And what did he say when you told him what Michel Francois was doing?
Well, he didn't say much. At the time, Mr. Terry was more interested in pushing me into an armed confrontation with the putschist, which I think was an attempt to undermine President Aristide. He didn't seem to be very interested in Michel Francois' drug dealing.
You know, it's interesting. I'm looking at the Saturday edition of the Washington Post that reported on the fact that Michel Francois has been indicted. And it says that in the early years of the military government, Francois was clearly the most powerful figure in Haiti, a key leader of the repression that took several thousand lives. As police chief, Francois was regularly briefed by U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration officials who shared intelligence with him and his men on suspected drug smuggling operations in Haiti, even as the exiled Aristide was denouncing the role of the military military and drug trafficking. Francois was also part of a U.S.-trained counter-narcotics intelligence unit formed in the late 1980s to combat drug trafficking in Haiti, which was known as the SIN, the National Intelligence Service. So the U.S. was working with him right through the coup, as you are pointing out yourself.
No, and after the coup also, you know what I mean? And this is extremely interesting. You know, SIN was a unit I was in the process of dismantling. And it is also one of the reasons why after the coup I became one of the most wanted people by the military, including, of course, Michel Francois. Now, something that the American public has to be very, very aware of is that people like Francois are a creation of the American so-called intelligence agencies, and that I am afraid that his arrest is not so much part of a search for justice or for truth, but it's a new way to bring him under control.
You know, it makes you wonder what Michel Francois is not agreeing to cooperate to now that he's been arrested. I mean, the same thing with Noriega, who was on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency, but eventually he fell out of favor with the CIA. According to the indictment, Francois had an airstrip built on the property of Haitian Colonel Jean-Claude Paul for drug trafficking and arranged the appointment of conspirators to key government positions. Among the Colombian drug lords, he conspired with the late Pablo Escobar, head of the Medellin cartel. It can't be that in 1997, this is when the U.S. government learned of this. I mean, this is something that you and President Aristide were saying from 1990.
Yes, but, you know, even more interesting, when the U.S. went in with 20,000 troops, right, how come they didn't arrest Michel Francois then? His role in drug trafficking had already been not only pointed out by us, but also had come up in 1994 when an informant, I believe who was a Colombian, testified in front of a Senate commission in 1994, before the Operation Uphold Democracy. Mm. So how come they didn't arrest him then?
How come they didn't, Patrick Haley?
Yes. The man was very useful to the CIA for a number of years, you know, dealing with Haitian Democrats, in fact, killing Haitian Democrats.
We're talking to Patrick Haley, who actually we're talking to from the Northern Neck Regional Jail in Warsaw, Virginia, a remote facility, and we'll talk about why you're being held there. But before we do, I want to continue with Michel Francois. The producer of Democracy Now!, Dan Coughlin, wrote a piece for Interpress Service a couple years ago called The Rehabilitation of Michel Francois, and he reminds me that at the time that Carter, Jimmy Carter, and Colin Powell and Sam Nunn went down to negotiate an end to the military regime, it was the time when the military was actually complimenting Michel Francois on working with the U.S. government. And after the negotiation and Aristide, and it was agreed that Aristide would return, Michel Francois was brought to the border so that he could go into the Dominican Republic by John Camborian, then the CIA station chief in Haiti. Sound familiar?
Yes, it does. And not only this, you know, Michel Francois, even after the return of President Aristide at the time when I was Secretary of State for Defense, was being used by the Americans, American Defense Institution. I remember General Meade almost threatening me with the return of Michel Francois. And he praised him as being a very competent man. And at the time, President Aristide wanted for the Haitian army to be dismantled, whereas the Americans wanted this army to be more or less incorporated within the new police. And being President Aristide's frontman on this issue, I was, taking a lot of flack from my American counterparts. And, they at some point, my opposition to the Haitian military was almost a cause for direct threats on my life by my American counterparts.
General Meade was the head of Operation Uphold Democracy.
Take over, yes, after General Sheldon, mm-hmm. You see. And you were right in pointing to the very important role that Michel Francois and FRAP played in that plan to destroy the Haitian popular movement.
Explain that.
Yes, this, you see, it was a plan to control the Haitian masses through terror and through corruption. You will always find these two tactics working together. Michel Francois was doing most of the killing and the corruption, for which he had, the large amount of money generated by not only the drug trades, but a number of other rackets. So this way, these people could go into, for example, the shanty towns like Cité Soleil, or to the neighborhood where Aristide was very strong, and buy some of these people to use them as pawn and as goons to terrorize the majority of these popular neighborhoods.
Patrick A. Lee, this afternoon, the confirmation hearings for the director of Central Intelligence, who has been nominated, Anthony Lake, is expected to begin. Anthony Lake was key in the U.S. occupation of Haiti. Can you tell us what you would like to see the senators ask Anthony Lake about what's happening in Haiti now and about the relationship with Michel Francois?
I think the senator should ask Mr. Lake how he plans to clean up the CIA, if that agency can be cleaned up. It is obvious, or it should be obvious, that the CIA has been involved in all kinds of crimes against not only countries and people like Haiti, Central America, but against the American people themselves, because it is clear that these killers that the CIA has been nurturing and using in countries like mine have also been the one bringing tons and tons of cocaine and other drugs into the U.S.
Anthony Lake went down to Haiti many times as national security advisor for President Clinton. He and Strobe Talbot were intimately involved in the U.S. occupation. What did you think of what Anthony Lake did there?
Well, I'd say the jury is still out on Mr. Lake. In many ways, I should say, to be frank, that we found some people within the Clinton administration to be decent and to really want to turn U.S. policy in a country like Haiti. But so far, the U.S. administration is not of one mind. You see, I have been a witness to a lot of infighting within the U.S. Power structure, and I believe people like Mr. Lake and Mr. Clinton are, in fact, very powerless within the U.S. power structure. I might be mistaken in my evaluation of the situation, but in many ways, I think Mr. Lake will find the CIA as hostile to him and to reform as the Haitian army was hostile to President Aristide when he came into power.
Patrick A. Lee, before you go, I want to talk about your own case. You're currently in the Northern Neck Regional Jail in Warsaw, Virginia, a remote facility in Virginia. There was a very interesting Washington Post piece on you recently that talks about your case and the fact that a judge in a November ruling said that it shocks the conscience that Patrick A. Lee would be detained so long without trial, since if you were convicted, your sentence likely would be shorter than the time you've already spent in jail. Clearly, your detention is politically significant. You've had aides to Senator Jesse Helms and Congressman Benjamin Gilman visiting you, both Republicans, on their foreign affairs committees in the Senate and the House. Can you explain right now how long you've been in detention and why you're being held?
Okay. Next month will be a year since I've been arrested and detained without any adjudication of guilt. I haven't been tried yet, and there is no date for my trial. So, now, the official reason for me being arrested was that I allegedly impersonated a diplomat and that I gave a wrong address while buying a firearm in Virginia. These are the official reason. But the true reason I've become aware of that was to neutralize me at a time where the Haitian police, the new Haitian security institution are being built, and where I could have played a key role in helping shape this institution the way the Haitian people want it, rather than the way the American defense or intelligence agencies want it to be shaped. I think this is the main reason.
Let me ask, you've been in jail now for almost a year. You haven't had a trial. Do you expect to see Michel Francois perhaps as a bunkmate?
Maybe Michel Francois will come to Northern Neck. I don't know. But I'll tell you, Emmy, and I say that very serenely, I am, in a way, a dead man walking. I don't know when I will be tried, and I don't know when I'll be released, if I'll be safe. I doubt that very much. I know a lot of things about the crimes that have been committed in my country and other countries by the so-called, authorities in this country. And for that, I think I'm a marked man.
Well, let me end by asking, there's a defense committee for you in Brooklyn, New York. How can people get in touch with it?
Okay, they can call this number, 718-835-2695. But I also advise them to call their congressman to denounce, the injustice that is being done to me, and through me, that is being done to truth. The reason I'm being kept in jail is so that I don't say what I know to be the truth.
Well, Patrick A. Lee, we want to thank you very much for joining us from the detention center in Virginia. Again, I'll give out that number for people who want to find out more about Patrick A. Lee's case. It's a Brooklyn, New York number. It's 718-835-2695. And we're going to continue with our discussion of Haiti, talking about the CIA, but also talking about conditions there, as again, President Clinton considers this one of his great foreign policy successes. And the confirmation hearings that will take place today for Director of Central Intelligence, Anthony Lake, are very significant and will raise probably the issue of Haiti, since he is considered one of the major architects of the policy. You're listening to Democracy Now! In just a minute, we'll be joined by former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Stay with us. Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Later this afternoon, the Senate confirmation hearings begin for President Clinton's nominee for Director of Central Intelligence. Anthony Lake is formerly the National Security Advisor to the President. And we expect he'll begin, or the questioning will begin, around the FBI and what it did tell or didn't tell the National Security Council, which he headed, about warnings that the Chinese government might try to influence U.S. congressional elections. You heard earlier in the show that President Clinton is saying that the FBI did not warn him or the White House about this possible Chinese influence peddling. But the FBI is saying they did turn to the National Security Council, which Anthony Lake heads. So we expect that will begin the questioning this afternoon. But Anthony Lake is also known as the architect of the administration's Haiti policy. And here to discuss the Clinton policy in Haiti is Ramsey Clark, former U.S. Attorney General under the President Lyndon Johnson administration, before that Assistant Attorney General under President Kennedy. Ramsey Clark has just come from visiting Haiti. In fact, he's been there for many years. He's visited there many times over the last four decades. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, why don't we begin with your observations about Haiti today, since it is considered by the U.S. government to be one of their great successes in restoration of democracy?
Economically, Haiti's at least as miserable, probably more miserable than it's been in the last 20 or 30 years. But overriding that is a new sense of desperation or crisis, because time and time again, the people have been misled about their future, and instead of getting better, it's gotten worse. Unemployment there is absolutely staggering. Violence is prevalent. The last weekend we were there, 15 people were killed in Cité Soleil alone, which is not a healthy climate. So it's an awful situation, and you really see the consolidation of an economic repression that will be extremely difficult for the people to get out of.
What does that have to do with the United States government? I mean, I would guess the U.S. would say that's Haiti's problem. They went there to restore democracy and President Aristide.
Well, that's what they said, but in fact, they had stolen 60% of President Aristide's term from him, hadn't they? I mean, he lost 3 of 5 years in exile in the United States. He was forced to agree not to run for re-election as a condition of his return. He was left impotent the last year of his term, and the elections simply established a continuation of the coup, a new aristocracy. The Préval government, barely over a year now after it was installed, is extremely unpopular. It has virtually no support among certainly the masses of the people. And of all the policies that we've had, I think the several that are most devastating are we've preserved the capacity for violence through military and police terror. It's the same thing that happened after the flight of Baby Doc Duvalier on a U.S. Air Force plane, by the way. People thought that was the end of the Tonton Macoute. Shortly after the coup that overthrew President Aristide, which was really led at the presidential palace by Colonel Francois, who you were talking about earlier, we walked downtown and there were 700 Tonton Macoute out with their red bandanas and their blue dungarees, and they've been underground the whole time. Now we have virtually intact the capacity for the military to return, for the FRAP, aptly named FRAP, for the attachés and the remnants of the old Tonton Macoute. The people are still subject to the threat of that reign of terror that's been their condition for the last several generations. Most devastatingly economically is is the insistence, absolute insistence of the United States with its coercing the World Bank if it needed it. It's saying the same thing. And the International Monetary Fund and international private lenders to insist on what they call a structural adjustment policy in Haiti and in any other country. And structural adjustment really means the subjugation of the people to economic royalty. They're trying to sell off the assets of the people, destroy organized labor. In January, you had a nationwide strike brought by employees in the public sector that was extremely effective because the people feel at such a loss. They feel so hopeless. But as they, I mean, look at, just take the public sector that they're trying to privatize, electricity, telephones, postal service. In Haiti today, 8 to 10% at most of the population has electricity in their homes, has access to a telephone in any place that they can visit. Do you really think that selling those facilities to private interests is going to expand the availability of the services to the poor? Absolutely not. It's going to cost those who have to pay for it more. It's going to enrich the rich, and it's going to impoverish the poor. Without rural electrification, would we have ever brought electricity to the farmlands of America with private capital? Of course not, because the cost of taking it out there was enormous. They're happy to buy it from us after we've put billions in public funds in, and then they can tax the people privately by charging more for their electricity. But you're never going to get more phone service. You're never going to get more electricity out to the people who need it for every reason that you need those services in a modern society through privatization. They've taken away any hope for the restoration of the public cement plant, the public wheat mill, other areas. What you really need is precisely the opposite of the structural adjustment plan that's being forced down their throats, and that's major investment in the public sector. It's the only way that the people are going to get services. It's like stealing the last little thing they have, the last little hope they have, by forcing this privatization on them. It's a form of grand larceny. It really is. Taking from the poor and giving to the rich. And in the meantime, we exploit their labor. You know, we're living in a world where 30% of the world's labor force is unemployed, and with technology and all, what's going to happen? The real question of the 21st century is going to be the poor countries and the poor people from the poor countries who go to the rich countries. And unless we do something really radical to provide some chance for their future, it's going to be miserable. You walk into the sweatshops down there where they're paying primarily women, you know, 15 to 30 cents an hour. Nothing. They can't support their children. They can't feed the kids. They can't clothe the kids. They can't take care of themselves. They got an hour and more transportation both ways that they can hardly afford. A lot of them walking clear across town to get out there. And they're stitching for Disney and other people at pennies. I mean, if they're lucky and are paid, which is not common, the minimum wage, they get $2.40 a day, less than 30 minutes of work under our minimum wage laws here in the United States. They take jobs from the U.S. They make them work under conditions where it costs practically nothing. There's no overhead. The standards of safety and all, you can't get decent drinking water in there. So we exploit their labor. It's a hopeless situation for them. They see it, and Haiti is restless.
You were talking to Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General, who's just returned from a trip to Haiti. Now, if the Senate Intelligence Committee raises the issue of Haiti with Anthony Lake today or in the next few days, they're going to raise a very different issue. The Republicans don't object to what you're describing in Haiti today. What they object to is that there have been a handful of killings of coup supporters. And those, they say, that has been inspired perhaps by President Aristide, or that they weren't fully investigated. And this is what they're going after Anthony Lake for. Who is National Security Advisor to Clinton, architect of the Haiti policy, has been down to Haiti along with Strobe Talbott many, many times. What do you make of that?
Well, it just shows how deeply entrenched our problems are. You know, we've talked of the CIA as being a rogue elephant since at least the Church Committee hearings. what what the Republican leadership in the Senate wants is a disciplined rogue elephant, if you will, one that selectively kills people that they find meddlesome or bothersome to their purposes. So really what they what they will see probably is that Lake is their kind of guy, that he, you know, if they made a few mistakes and let a few of the wrong people get murdered, it's just the cost of doing business that way.
Let me ask you, you're a person who, over the years, has gone to places where the CIA has been rather active, has gone to places that are considered unpopular by the U.S. administration, went to North Vietnam to examine the American bombing and visit U.S. POWs. You went to Iran to condemn U.S. support for the Shah. You're well known for your work in Iraq. Right now, the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, when she was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, perhaps is most well known for enforcing the embargo against Iraq. What are your feelings about the Central Intelligence Agency? And if you were one of those senators today on the Senate Intelligence Committee deciding the future of the CIA and the intelligence establishment, what issues would you be raising?
Well, I think in the broader sense, the confirmation hearing today has, you know, little significance. Anthony Lake will be far from our worst director of the CIA if he's confirmed. I've believed for a long, long time that we really have to abolish the CIA as it's now constituted, that it's so institutionally deeply ingrained in policies and conduct that are, I'd like to say, anti-American. They're contrary to the fundamental rights of people and the decent conduct of government, that you shouldn't try to reform it. You know, it's kind of like trying to reform the penitentiary system. It doesn't happen. It doesn't work because the concept is wrong. We ought to start over. I'm not a know-nothing. I believe, in fact, knowing everything. If anything, outside of the areas of privacy, I'm a data addict. I would like our Central Information Agency to try to gather from public sources, which are always the most reliable and which always have the most comprehensive information, everything we need to know about every place, starting at home, of course, and have it available to anybody who wants it. Instead, what we do is we have this concept of clandestine operations. It leads us deeper and deeper into murderous activity. I mean, it goes beyond the CIA, of course. When you think of our training police and methods of torture, when you think of Colonel Francois and the misery that he's inflicted on the people of Haiti, when you think of the hundreds killed out there in front of the presidential palace the night President Aristide was driven from Haiti, and when you realize that that's our responsibility, we are responsible as citizens of these United States for the acts of our agents. And if we want to do anything serious about the CIA, we would dismantle it, and then we wouldn't be subject to all the mistakes that come from the misinformation that it broadcasts to leadership and the public and to itself.
You know, I don't know if we said earlier in the cast, but during the coup, The Nation magazine exposed that FRAP, the leading terror organization, the paramilitary organization in Haiti, was set up by the Central Intelligence Agency and the DIA, the Defense Information Agency, which is the CIA of the Pentagon, because Aristide, who was here, the U.S. didn't feel that if he went back, he would enforce a line that they appreciated, and they wanted him to cave and set up a kind of counter to Lava Loss, which was the FRAP that killed so many people. And finally, President Aristide did say, "We'll stop the killing. I'll go back." And then came back and gave up so much of his popular agenda that he had swept into power in 1990.
That's true. He was powerless on FRAP and Constant. The amazing thing is that people are surprised. I mean, you know, where have we been? What else would we expect? Of course we help organize and support those organizations. We always have. If we should be surprised about anything, is that it comes out as clearly and publicly as it did. But then what do? We don't do anything about it. I mean, as Patrick A. Lee was saying earlier about Colonel Francois, you know, why now? And why did Constantine enjoy the hospitality of the United States for all the years that he was here, knowing of the role that he had played?
And continues to enjoy it today.
His organization means hit him, you know, frap. It's onomatopoeia. That's what it means. It's like whack.
Well, and it does mean, in fact, to hit, to punch.
That's right. But it comes from the sound.
We just have a minute to go, and since you were the former Attorney General of the United States under President Lyndon Johnson, I wanted to ask what you think about Janet Reno today, the current Attorney General, and the pressure on her right now to appoint an independent counsel in the case of the kind of fundraising and the antics that have been carried on by the administration, not to mention what's been going on in Congress to raise the millions of dollars, actually more than $2 billion for campaigns. And I wanted to ask what you would do in this situation.
Well, you only know what you think you ought to do. You don't know what you would do. But obviously, the pressure on her to appoint an independent counsel is partisan and political. Obviously, an independent counsel should have been appointed long before now, not because of partisan political pressure, but because it's the obviously correct thing to do under the law. When you know, we don't have a democracy here, in spite of the name of your program. This government is a plutocracy. If we don't see that, we fail to understand the very essence of our existence. We are controlled by wealth. Even our democratic processes are controlled by wealth. And it's not even our own wealth all the time. It's Indonesia and other people. But how can the government, dependent upon that wealth, how can the political administration, how can the Democratic National Committee be expected to permit its agencies to effectively investigate? You need an independent counsel, as poor as the quality of their work has generally been. About Janet Reno generally, I like her. I really feel badly about Waco. She came in at a terrible time and has that burden to carry. And she has no support from the president. You can't be a strong attorney general when your own president doesn't support you.
Well, Ramsey Clark, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I should clarify that Democracy Now! Is a demand. It's not a description of what we have in this country today. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Well, that brings us to the end of our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Errol Maitland. Errol Maitland's engineer in New York today. Kenneth Mason is our engineer here in Washington. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230, or you can get that mug to send to the president, coffee, tea, and me, challenging what's been going on at the White House. That's 1-800-735-0230. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.